As they connect to China, we'll use that as a segue to talk about our third topic, which is China. I mean, I sit here and I'm a big proponent of the idea that, you know, that they are busily mining and keeping all the gold that they mine and importing as much as they can. Eventually, they're converting their dollar reserves into gold, and eventually they're going to be backing some type of new international trade settlement system. And you and I have talked in the past about, you know, different alternatives to how they might do that. It's not as if I feel like there's some kind of, oh, I can't wait for the Chinese to take over the world, because that's not anything I think we should be pulling for. But it does seem like an eventuality that they're going to act in their own best interest, as you might expect. So some of the questions we got on China was, you know, we had this Chinese, I guess he was like a Chinese treasury official, who just last weekend said that we needed some type of new Bretton Woods system, some type of new global reserve currency system. And the question then to you is, I guess, multiple stems off the same question. What is the most likely structure and timetable for a new system? Will Russia be involved, or, you know, would Russia do it themselves? They're in a more powerful position, it would seem, militarily, to confront the U.S. Is this a good thing? Who are the good guys to pull for in all of this? And then finally, would this be a new system, or is it just simply the same old bankers who's always been in charge of everything that are behind a shift to a more Eastern power base? I mean, that's a lot to chew on, but I'll just give you the floor and let you run with it again.
Oh man, loaded question, but I enjoy it. I don't say a loaded question, oh, what a pain. No, this is interesting, relevant stuff that we're dealing with, a global situation that's on the verge of tremendous change and what many experts call paradigm shift.
Right.
Okay, the Chinese are going to pursue the new Bretton Woods. That's their way of saying we want the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And it's going to happen. They must do some things in order to bring this about that aren't in existence yet. And here's one of the biggest. They've made steps. Well, they is China. I'll introduce Russia in a minute. But China has already made some steps for establishing a solid convertible capital account. By that I mean, just think of it as a national bank account that can be used for trading, like, say, New Zealand dollars. It can trade Colombian pesos. It can trade Swiss francs. It can trade South Korean won. It can trade anything. It's a capital account. It's like, okay, anybody's got money, even in Africa and South America or wherever, and they bring it to the window for the capital account where it gets converted. That defines full convertibility. They're working on that. They're actually – it's not like, well, they're going to start. They have months of progress on that, and it's not a simple thing. But let me point out something that's right in front of our noses and is not being properly recognized for what it is. It's called the Yuan Swap Facility. Now, I first noticed this back in – I think it was 07, might have been a year before, with Brazil.
Right.
I try to date certain things by where was I sitting, what window was I looking out when that happened. And I remember this became a very big story when I was living in Sabana, which is a western suburb of San Jose, Costa Rica. Okay, that was summer of 07. And I integrated that into my report saying, this is going to be a big and growing concept because I didn't bring in the concept of barter. I didn't link it with barter. I thought of it as this is dollar alternative bypass. So Brazil and China essentially set up three – just think of it as three major banks in China and three major banks in Brazil, and they handled all the traffic, all the trade traffic for money. And all the conversion went through them, and no dollars changed hands, no dollars except maybe on ledger items converted into Brazilian real and Chinese yuan. All right, the Chinese swap facility has been doing something critically important for this transition. It's been weaning country after country off the dollar,
right,
for trade settlement. And now you've got a long list. I mean, I had a client send me a list the other day, and I couldn't believe it. Oh, my gosh. They even have Belarus in there.
Yeah.
It's Australia. It's now France. It's Switzerland. It's England. It's Japan. It's Korea. I said Belarus. Russia's in there. Mm-hmm.
India. It goes on and on. Yeah.
Malaysia. Okay. What you're seeing is the core of all the G20 is in this, and now you're getting elements of the G7. So when clownish radio guests come on and say the dollar's going to rule the waves for the next 20 years, I say, gosh, you've been asleep the last five?
Yeah.
So a lot is going on, but here's how it's going to be different. It's going to be a return to the dollar. I'm sorry, a return to the gold standard. But it's going to be very different. It's not going to be, all right, well, all the currency now have to be backed by gold. No. The euro bonds and the treasury bonds, they all have to be backed by gold. No. They're going to all just get wasted. They're going to, if they don't get defaulted, they're going to get converted in these gigantic global summit debt restructure meetings where the U.S. military is sitting outside the room. Uh-huh. And just like the Bolsheviks in Leningrad, they're going to have naval outfits pointing their howitzers and their big guns at the meeting. So that's how the euro and the dollar are going to be resolved. In the meantime, on the other side of the world, where a lot of Western analysts have gigantic blind spots, I noticed that I made a list of 10 analysts who I really respect, and not one of them, regarding the dollar and gold, not one of them ever mentions anything about Eastern dollar alternative trade systems. Apparently, they don't have any information. Well, I do, and I'm very fortunate for that. The Voice has been feeding me information on dollar alternatives for the last 2 years. He got my attention 2.5 years ago when he talked about the dollar kill switch with the Persian Gulf oil producers. In other words, turning off the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And he described how it's going to be different. Notice that the Iran sanctions made very clear that the Western banks control the banks through the SWIFT codes. Okay. The new alternative that doesn't use a dollar will not use the banks and not be involved with SWIFT code obstacles. Okay. Notice that there's a lot of trouble when it comes to dollar conversion using the Forex and these dollar-based transactions, they must be converted, and the Forex is the room where it happens. The new trade settlement system, it's going to be gold-based. It will not use the banks, therefore no SWIFT obstacles, and not use the currencies, therefore not be subject to Forex rules and conversions. What will it use? It'll be gold trade settlement, gold trade notes, working as letters of credit that are purchased with gold deposits, gold put on margin, and the rest satisfied later, whatever. It'll involve a gold trade central bank. Notice that the BRICS Development Fund that was mentioned in March and April has changed its name to the BRICS Bank.
Okay. Oh, I noticed that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, how about next year when they change it to the gold central bank, gold trade central bank, that captured your attention too?
Yeah, that might get my attention as well.
Well, that's what it's going to be, because I'm told that it's going to be a processing plant for treasury bonds. Remember the indirect exchange concept?
Right.
I'm sort of sending it back to the sender, return to the sender.
Right.
All right, well, now you've got Brazilian reserves, you've got Indonesian reserves, you've got Japanese reserves, you've got Indian reserves, you've got Iran reserves. They're all going to be shoving it through the BRICS bank, converting it into gold bullion.
Yeah.
So that's what the BRICS bank is all about. And I'm told that there's going to be a key feature for the gold trade settlement, two key features. One is the role of Turkey, and the other is the role of what they call peer-to-peer.
Okay.
Notice that Turkey has been really important in helping out Iran. It's their neighbor. They've got, a few thousand years of experience, a lot more experience than the United States and Canada have as neighbors.
Right.
All right, so you've got Iran that had to deal with the Iran bank sanctions. The biggest backfire in, I believe, U.S. finance history, the Iran sanctions. So they're trying to sell gas to India and using Turkish gold. What has happened in the last year is the evolution of the Turkish role as gold intermediary banker. Two parties come to Turkey and say, look, we want to settle our trade on a net basis in gold. They appeal to the Turkish banks and say, can you help us buy some gold in order to settle this? So the Turkish come in, Turkish banks say, sure, we'll do that. We've been doing that for 5,000 years. This dollar is a new phenomenon.
Right.
Gold is not. So the peer-to-peer element is the other aspect of this trade settlement that's coming. It will mean that two parties like in Bolivia and Shanghai can conduct their transactions on BlackBerries. Not banks, but peer-to-peer, because they've got in between, they've got the letters of credit, gold trade notes, and in between, they've got Turkey working as an intermediary to handle on a net basis. Bolivia needs cars, Bolivia needs electronics, home electronics, they need PCs, they need iPhones. All right, and the Chinese need the silver, they need the tin, need the iron. Okay, the role of Russia and China together, I believe they're going to be the leaders of this movement. And they're already integrating now the Eurasian trade zone.
Right.
I think we talked about that last time I was on.
We've talked about that several times.
Just think of their energy pipelines as being the backbone, the skeletal system of that trade zone. I've got an interesting way of looking at it. China is really providing the main spearhead. But they're doing so on the financial side. China decided we're going to challenge the dollar. We're going to challenge the U.S. on financial matters. And they made that decision a few years ago. I believe they made that decision when the United States betrayed China on the most favored nation accord, which had a backside of leasing their gold. Rubin arranged for leasing Mao Zedong era gold and told the Chinese, we'd pay you back in 06 or 07. We betrayed them, and now the Chinese are angry. Ever since that, they've been taking the lead in confronting on the financial front. So China is to finance what Russia is to the tangible side. Russia's got heavy railroads that are going from Russia to Germany. They all stop in Germany. So who's going to be the next partner that teams up with Russia and China? Hint, hint.
Yeah, the Germans.
Ending in Germany.
Yeah.
I don't care what's going on with Merkel. Merkel's an effing clown. She's a clown. She's a tool. She's like a bitch for the Euro Commission. She's a bitch for the London banks. Wait for the elections then. We'll cover that in a bit. But, okay, there's going to be a reliable, credible system. It's going to have some hidden elements, the peer-to-peer, the Turkish intermediaries. It's going to handle the whole new system is going to be outside the current banking system, and it's going to be outside the Forex. And when it happens, it's going to be a shock. I don't know if it's going to come in stages or it's going to come in maybe one or two very big thuds where the platforms fall 10 feet and everybody on stage is no longer standing. But the U.S. is going to fall into the deindustrialized third world. I'm not calling it third world anymore because we're not talking about areas that never had capitalization. This is going to be deindustrialized. You know, just look at Detroit. Look at some of the other,
right.
East Louis, Illinois. Just look at some of these cities that used to have American industry where the labor unions or the environmentalists or the corporates just decided, well, we're going to exploit cheaper labor in other countries, and the outsourcing started. The U.S. is going to fall into the third world, and three major things will happen as a result. Price inflation from the dollar having to be devaluated because it'll have to fight on its own merits. If you take away the dollar for trade settlement, especially after the Saudis announced that they will accept British pounds, Swiss francs, Japanese yen, euros, bring them all. We don't necessarily need dollars anymore. And by the way, King Abdullah is clinically dead. So you got a change of the guard happening in the House of Saudis. The U.S. dollar will have to fight on its own merits, and it will become front page news that, hey, gee whiz, the U.S. dollar and its finances from the U.S. government, they look just like third world. That's something that Jack has been saying for 4 years.
Hey, Jim, I'm going to interrupt you for a second because I want to redirect you on two specific points. One, a question I had from one of the readers that said, you know, guys like Mish are out there saying, no, the Saudis already take euro. I don't understand this whole petrodollar infatuation. And then two, people just posted some news items this week about King Abdullah doing this and King Abdullah doing that. Has he been seen in public? Does anybody know for certain that he's one way or the other?
I don't know. The Saudis are pretty good about taking photographs from 2 years ago and making a front page story about it.
Yeah, no,
news stories in Saudi Arabia last month saying he was clinically dead. All of his organs are dysfunction. They're not working. His brain waves are dead. His organs are dead.
All right. Well, it'd be easy to put out a statement saying King Abdullah says this, you know, just easy to put that out there.
King Abdullah's younger brother put out the story.
Right.
These are a bunch of inbred, very weak younger brothers, half-brothers, who are battling for the throne. And the last thing they want to come out with is a big statement, a national global news item saying, Abdullah's dead, what are we going to do?
Right.
So price inflation is going to hit the United States, and the rate of price inflation will be about half of what the dollar is devaluated by. So if they have a 30% devaluation, a sudden 15% hit to prices in the U.S. economy. There's also going to be supply shortages because Wall Street likes to control things, and by controlling prices, they limit supply and shortages result. Look for fighting, conflicts, shooting, explosions of all kinds at food and gasoline centers. Namely, supermarkets and gas centers.
Sure.
Gas stations. So chaos and disorder will come when this all happens. Now, the foreigners, they're going to be slow in bringing this about because it's very complicated. This is not something that you say, well, you know, we're going to work on this in a couple of weeks. We'll have it all set. They've been working on this for two or more years. And I was told a year ago, 2012, that the systems are ready for basic function now. Told that in the summer of 2012. Maybe that's why they tried to drain the London gold supply at that time, because they knew they were ready on the other end.
Right.
So you get China on the finance side, Russia on the tangible side, and Russia is going to be using their clout as far as energy in bringing about geopolitical change in Europe.
And all their natural resources that they're rich in, yeah.
They're already saying now, Turd, to Germany, get on board. You're a little slow here. Mm-hmm. They're already telling the European nations, we'll keep your gas supply, including England, provided that you do the following things in cooperation. They're already – it's not blackmail. It's commerce. We will play ball with you if you play ball with us.
And why would you not want to?
Well, they're going to want to for survival reasons.
Exactly.
I think the British Isles want to keep their energy supply.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Jim, you're being very gracious with your time, and that's what this format is supposed to be about. I mean, it's not supposed to be a 15-minute, you know, quick hitting interview. I want people to have access to your big, crazily functioning smart brain. And you're sharing that with us today, and I appreciate it. But it has been 45 minutes, so I feel like I want to redirect you into the last subject.
Oh, good. We're not going to cut it off.
No, not yet. In what you were just talking about, though, again, I think it's a perfect segue, because for millennia, whoever has the gold has the power. No question about it. And the fact that China, they haven't even reported their official gold reserves now for 4 years. When they do, even if that's only half of what they actually have, who knows, you know, how reliable it is, it's going to amaze everybody that they will then have the power in this new system because they have the gold. And I would relate that all the way down to us all as individuals. That's why we stack, because even as individuals, if you have the gold, you will at least retain some financial power. Let's talk about the GLD, and you can even tie in, again, this run on London, the run on the COMEX stocks, which are reported at least. You know, that information can't be deemed reliable, as you know, as they now even openly state. But let's talk about this physical gold phenomenon. What do you know about the GLD specifically? Is it, you know, they would purport it to be unencumbered gold, but I think it's more likely leased and it was funded, and the gold that initially went in there was all leased and rehypothecated with multiple claims of ownership. As a statistician, is there a point where this rate of withdrawal, which is already now a full third of the GLD supposed inventory, has been liquidated just this year? So where there used to be three bars, there are now two. Is there a point where that goes parabolic and there's a scramble to get out? And then tying this all back together, you've spoken before about this allocated gold scandal in Switzerland. I mean, all of this ties back to the fractional reserve LBMA system, which is fracturing and falling apart as we speak. But again, there's a long kind of big umbrella for you to talk under. I'll just shut up now and let you roll with it.
Okay, let me preface things by, I have two impressions regarding GLD investors. They're either incurable financial junkies who want a trading vehicle for today, or they're total investment morons who haven't figured out that the GLD really doesn't have any gold for them. So when they're investing in gold with GLD, because it's so simple, you just hit GLD in a click. Yeah. They're not buying any gold. They're not buying any gold at all. I've come to learn something very interesting about GLD and its connection with the mining firms. And what seemed to bring this to the fore was Barrick's trouble with Pascua Lama.
Right.
And their announcement that, gee, we're just not going to be able to bring that supply like we were expecting next year. And all kinds of legal problems. You could make a long list of what their problems are. Strikes, legal problems, challenges for actual ownership of the deposits. Germans stepping in and saying we own a lot of property, maybe not in South America, but African property owned by Barrick supposedly. What I came to learn, and I'm sorry, also the Utah landslide in Kennecott.
Right.
That was owned by Rio Tinto, I believe.
Yes.
Okay, so what is the upshot? A lot of less big mine projects are going to have output of gold. Well, what's the impact of that? Well, move on down the stream, and you see that that's a GLD issue. The GLD is going to have less gold. And then I had a brilliant paragraph sent to me by a fellow I call Euro Raj. He's a very bright guy. He's got some London connections, and he's really tied in with what's happening with Iran, India, and Turkey, which is really important in the eastern side of the world when you're not focusing on Russia and China. There's a second layer in this eastern alliance, and Iran, Turkey, and India are very much part of it. So what I came to learn from Euro Raj is the GLD is nothing more than an inventory constantly shifting of what he called gold in motion.
Yeah.
And he said it's like the Wells Fargo stagecoach. Okay, they hit a location in Nebraska, and off one bag goes, on one bag comes. And that explains somewhat the constantly shifting and controversial bar list.
Yeah.
For the GLD. They don't have a consistent list. In fact, they even had an example a year ago where clown on CNBC, I think it was Pusani, unwittingly, because he doesn't know anything about gold, showed a bar from the GLD, and it wasn't even owned by the GLD.
Exactly.
They have no idea what they're doing.
Andrew McGuire has talked about that at length, that it's a, he calls it a flywheel, that they just spin gold in and out of there to wherever it needs to go.
Right, and gold in motion is very consistent with that concept, and
right.
So is Wells Fargo's stagecoach,
right.
Which is something that maybe some of us older folks, I'm over 60 now, so I remember old Western movies where the Wells Fargo stagecoach came on, and it had a guy running shotgun, who
right.
Usually was the first one shot by the Indians with a bow and arrow. Anyway, so there's a core inventory of the GLD. And I don't believe the issue is so much that it's encumbered and leased and hypothecated. I believe that the main issue is it's available for midnight raids by the big banks. They read the prospectus. It says the big banks, if they put together a sufficient basket, can put together, say, 10,000 shares.
100,000.
Is it 100,000 shares?
Yeah.
Okay, 100,000 shares, and then just help themselves to inventory out the back door in the middle of the night.
Yep.
And these moron investors who think that they've owned gold and got some good exposure to gold, they're going to have to realize sooner or later, why is there this big discount on the GLD versus the spot price? Well, it's because you're a moron, and you haven't noticed that the GLD doesn't have much gold. It's gold in motion, and you have no claim on it. All right, so there, it's not so much an issue of multiple claims of the ownership, but rather multiple hands having access to take your gold. Okay. The problem is not the claims, but the inventory replenishment and replacement. As for the decline, I think it's already now in parabolic descent for inventory volumes. Now we're starting to see two phenomena hit the GLD. One is the Shanghai, and the other is the COMEX.
Right.
Shanghai has a price differential. They call it the spread. And this is paper versus paper. So don't get this confused with actual physical markets. So the Shanghai futures contract is anywhere between $25 and $40 higher. Sometimes it's $50.
Yep.
Sometimes it's lower. And I don't really know why it varies so much. I guess satisfaction of some contracts running arbitrage. If you take a look at the correlation in the last 18 months of the premium of the Shanghai price in gold versus the COMEX, you see that it's minus 80% correlated with the exiting flow from the GLD vaults of gold. That's a remarkable correlation, and I'm a statistician. I have a lot of experience looking at data sets and regression models and all kinds of different things, and I can tell you that a correlation of 80% is seen only in the scientific laboratory.
Give that again, Jim. I want to make sure everybody caught that.
There's a minus, I think it's minus 81% correlation in the last few years between the Shanghai price premium and the exiting flow of gold from the GLD vaults. And if you look at the last 18 months, it's even higher.
So is...
I'm sorry. I got that wrong. I want to get this right. I don't have all the numbers in front of me. I think the last 7 years has a minus 50% correlation. But I'm doing some rough calculating in my own mind. And in the last 18 months, it's more like minus 80% correlation between... What you see is, all right, you got a big rise. Give it to a concrete example. A big rise in the last couple of weeks in the Shanghai price versus COMEX.
Mm-hmm.
It went from 25 to 45 suddenly. Whoops, out went a whole bunch more of GLD inventory. So hand in hand goes increases Shanghai versus London, New York, hand in hand with exiting volume from the ramps on GLD inventory.
Interesting.
Very interesting. That's one. The other one is that we're seeing, this is just remarkable, this is smoking gun material. JP Morgan meets a certain gold delivery, and three digits are correct for matching the drawdown on the GLD vaulted inventory. They're satisfying COMEX delivery with GLD inventory. This is just remarkable smoking gun stuff.
Right.
So, you know, you could say that the GLD is an actual fund. I think of it more as a warehouse where the inventory is constantly shifting. If you take a look at a warehouse, like say at Best Buy, they got televisions in their warehouse. They're in boxes. And you take a look at all the serial numbers, the barcodes, and you run off 100 TV sets this week. Well, you look at it 3 weeks later, you still got 100 there, but they got different barcodes. That's what's going on with the GLD. I think the withdrawals have turned parabolic. Most people think a parabolic means that there's nothing left. Parabolic just attests to the rate of descent.
Right, right.
The rate of change.
Right.
And I remember, I think it was Harvey Oregon, and you produced this yourself. You say, well, what did it take to remove 100 tons from GLD a year ago. Well, it took about 4 months. What did it take to remove the next 100 tons? Well, it took about 2.5 months. The next 100 tons, well, it took about 6 weeks. The next 100 tons took about 4 weeks. Next 100 tons, about 3 weeks. That's your parabolic acceleration right there.
Right. And I think you could look at it as a percentage basis, too. You know, last night, 4.5 metric tons came out. Last night being Wednesday. 4.5 metric tons at this level of, you know, of an inventory of 900 metric tons is about the same as what, about 7-8 metric tons back when we were at the peak inventory.
Right.
And right. And so that's where it's parabolic. You're absolutely right.
Many ways of looking at that, but you've got to be careful about what does parabolic mean in its own definition.
Right.
In my view, it's confused somewhat. I had a very strange question about 2 years ago. Could you explain the difference between hyperbolic rise and parabolic rise and accelerated rise? Well, they're all pretty much the same, and there's no sense in getting all balled up in definitions that have to do with conic sections.
I would say you speak in grandiose terms really quickly about a parabolic rise. That would be you're hyperbolically accelerating your parabolic rise.
Just think it's accelerating. The decline is accelerating, and the time between 100-ton removals is shortening. That's what you need to focus on. As for the Swiss allocated gold lawsuits,
yes,
zero information. But there is something on the sidelines that is available, and that is about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Zurich Cantonal Bank, ZKB, they're often known as, announced that they're going to do the exact same thing that ABN AMRO did out of Netherlands. They were not going to honor requests for redemption of gold accounts in gold metal. They're going to have cash settlement. So why would ZKB do that unless they didn't have any gold? Why would ZKB do that unless they were balled up in some class action lawsuits? Yeah. I've done a little bit of checking, and it's very hard to verify, but a couple friends of mine and I are starting to conclude that these class action lawsuits have some preliminary contract signings of nondisclosure. That, yeah, you can sue us, and we will proceed through these very weird different labyrinths of Swiss court system. I don't even want to get into all their stupid, weird, tilted laws.
Yeah.
But you can enter the legal system for torts and work toward your damage claim in the Swiss courts, but you must sign a nondisclosure, which eliminates your whole claim if you ever go public and announce that you've got a $200 million claim against ZKB, for instance.
Which is not, I mean, you get the same thing in the American legal system. You know, you might settle some civil suit where, you know, as a part of that, the claimant pledges that, you know, a vow of secrecy, basically. And if they do talk about it, then they might get it taken back.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Let's get to some of these miscellaneous questions.
Well, yeah, let me just hit it.
I can hit them quickly.
Just a couple quick ones, and then we'll wrap up. I was looking at the list. I had a couple of miscellaneous questions for you, and I was sitting here looking at the list, trying to think of what other ones should we talk about in the time we have left. We talked about a number of things here that we've already covered. Let's just kind of wrap it up with this one. The power of the powers that be to hang on to their power is evident, but it could very well be a decision that is forthcoming. There could be something they did months ago, like the SWIFT system and what they did with Iran. What could be the final straw? I mean, do you have any guesses? What could be the thing that could finally set things into motion and make it all irreversible? Well, not that it's not already irreversible, but really begin this big shift, this big collapse.
I believe it's going to be one of two things, and these are broad things.
Sure.
One is finance and one is tangible. It's going to be a big bank that they just can't hold on anymore. It's so naive to say, well, gee, you know, they got these infinite resources in the printing press. Bank's in trouble, and they'll just fix it overnight. Okay, that's very flip, very naive, and very ignorant. because these banks are extremely complex, and every single one of the cables holding it together is broken. So you're saying, okay, we got this, you know, 150-story building, and all of its internals are broken, yet, you know, they're just going to put 18 hands on it and hold it up. It's not that simple anymore. The big banks and their derivatives are breaking. It's not just a matter of being insolvent. By being insolvent for 3 or 4 years, they've been unable to hold things together with leverage. They're having to hold things together with force and with phony money and with additional patches, like some of these Mickey Mouse jerk-off Euro bonds that Draghi has put on that are being declared illegal. All right, they're patches. Six months pass, and they realize these are worthless. They don't mean anything. They're just higher subordinated crap paper, toilet paper. The other thing that I believe, and Deutsche Bank is at the center of the weak link here. They've got a lot of VPs that are not at their desks. They got a lot of people who are not experienced because they replaced the VPs who left, who are now flipping and cooperating with Interpol. You've got all this stuff, and the irony, I think I forgot to mention, the irony in the Forex swaps run by the Deutsche Bank desks is that their Forex swaps consider gold and treat gold like a currency. I'd like to see some of them liquidated and the news stories come out. The other tangible side that could break things is what I call the natural gas co-op. And you're seeing some pipeline wars. You're seeing the U.S. trying to get in the way of the Iran-Pakistan pipeline. You see China come in and say, no, we're going to fund its completion, and we're going to have an extension from the West to Chinese provinces on their western borders. All right, so it's not being interrupted by the U.S. typical sanctions tactics that didn't work in Iran and will not work with Pakistan's pipeline. This natural gas co-op, I believe, has been accelerated in its development since Cyprus. That was March.
Right.
Gazprom had a giant bank called Gazprom Bank.
Right.
In Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
Hands off, Westerners. No bail-ins took place. They tried to freeze some accounts. Putin stepped in. They unfroze the accounts. No damage, no loss, no nothing. But Gazprom said, all right, you're going to play games like that. We're just not going to give so much emphasis to that anymore. And by the way, Cyprus served as the entire window for the Russian central bank and banking system. So it could be that the whole action taken against Cyprus was an action directed against the Kremlin and against Russia and against the Eastern Alliance that included China to try to forestall the dollar alternatives.
Yeah.
That's how big it is, and that's why I mention it as a natural gas co-op, because listen to these strange bedfellows that have climbed in on business with Russia's Gazprom. Turkmenistan always was there. That's a former Soviet republic. But now add to that Iran, Qatar, and Israel. And I think the funniest two in there are Qatar and Israel, because Qatar has now got some joint projects with Iran. They found a gigantic gas field in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, right across, in between the two.
They're not going to have war. They're going to have commerce.
Yeah.
The U.S. fosters war. The East fosters commerce. Then the other strange bedfellow is Israel with their Tamar floating platform.
Yep.
Unique technology there. It's not rooted with the floor bed, the seabed. And they signed a deal, I think it was in April or May or so, that the surplus gas is going to Gazprom. It's going to European market. Israel is not in the U.S. camp as much as people think.
Yeah.
They're not going to be declaring war against what I call the Shiite pipeline. That's the one that connects Iran with Syria.
Mm-hmm.
It goes through Shiite land. And I got news for you. The majority of certain parts of Iraq are Shiite. I mean, the U.S. is backing out and leaving Iraq a Shiite nation.
Right.
The U.S. just doesn't do anything right anymore on the foreign front. It's the Putin chess master versus the U.S. leaders. They're just like checkerboard people.
If that.
Bush and Obama, they're not even good at checkers. Obama has got outwitted for the new International Economic Summit coming up in Russia. They're not going to attend because of the embarrassment of Snowden. Yeah, so Russia provided haven, asylum for Snowden. Oh, gosh, that's a whole story in itself. Yeah. But this natural gas side, it has another angle regarding the United States. The shale energy projects are a Ponzi sham shell game.
You mean where they're doing the fracking and all that kind of jazz?
Yeah, the Bakken.
Right.
Oh, gosh. I could give you 20 minutes of arguments about how it's a total joke. You need to inject 3 units of energy to extract 1 unit of energy in the shale system. You need to invest in new wells in order to replace your depleting wells. How fast are the new shale wells depleting? How about 1 to 2 months? Mm. So you need an explosion in parabolic, there's your word again, in parabolic growth of new wells drilled. Well, gee, I got news for you. A couple of years, you're going to run out of sites.
Yeah.
Then what? Just like a Ponzi scheme, you run out of suckers to invest. And then enter the Halliburton element. Halliburton is the monopoly seller of fracking chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
The ban on the Gulf of Mexico took place after Halliburton was very much involved in the deep water horizon. they're very much on the scene with their suits that didn't have the orange construction look to them. And 12 hours later, the whole thing was up in flame with 12 dead. Halliburton recently had some lawsuits where they didn't admit guilt, but they had paid out some award damages for this and that. I don't have all the details, but
it's an interesting angle that we probably have to discuss at some point.
Yeah, you know, I'd rather not. But let's just say that the ban on the Gulf of Mexico offshore drilling greatly provided some advantages for fracking chemical sales.
It sure did. Yeah.
On land, where, by the way, to amplify their profitability, Halliburton had already bought up, before the sabotage of Deepwater Horizon, had bought up a lot of land contracts. So they were holder of land contracts to a large extent and a monopoly of fracking chemicals. Now, this shale energy
is interesting. Yeah,
it's just a total joke.
Never really put it all together like that, but that's
definitely. You know, and another piece in there, Turd, that Obama's personal investment accounts include some of these companies.
I would imagine. Well, Jim, we are at, an hour and 15 minutes. I suppose we better dial it in for now. But I know there's going to be great demand again in the future to have you back, and so we'll try to do this again. I want to conclude here, though. With these programs I'm trying to do once a week for all the subscribers, I thought, you know, we're going to call it Access to Access for now, but I thought I would conclude it each week with something. I heard this on the radio. I was driving this summer with the family and I was listening to the radio, and I heard a host on the radio conclude his interviews with something he called the Final Four, where he would just ask 4 quick questions.
Yeah,
okay. Just 4 quick questions, 4 quickies where you can answer, hopefully designed just for a one word or a one sentence answer. But I thought, you know, that might be kind of fun because, you know, we get into some different topics and get everybody a little flavor.
Yeah, I'm also not told in advance what these are, so this ought to be more fun. Go
this
ahead.
This ought to be an inch. All right, so anyway, so are you ready for the Final Four, Jim?
Yeah, I'm ready for Final Four.
All right, Jim. You, as a citizen of the world, I think everybody knows that you are an expat of the U.S. Are you a football fan, and will you be attending the World Cup next year?
I'm not only a soccer fan. I have 2 high school letters from high school. I'm sorry. I have 2 soccer varsity letters from high school. I was a mediocampista, as we say in Spanish. I was a midfielder. I was a left halfback. I did all the corner kicks for my soccer team, left side, right side. I was the only guy who could kick with both legs. I could kick 45 yards with my right and about 40 with my left. I'm right-footed. I've seen every World Cup since the 60s. I've never attended any, and I have no plans of going to Brazil for the World Cup, where the specialty in Rio is to steal your luggage.
Hopefully that's it that they take.
Well, you know, it's a crime-ridden area, and I think that the is the World Cup in Rio, or is that just the
Olympics? It's scattered all around Brazil.
Okay. I don't know where the finals are. Where's the finals going to be?
They're probably in Rio, yeah.
Okay. The World Cup is going to be great, and I'll watch it on television, and I'll try to do it at a sports bar with a bunch of Latinos because they get very emotional about it. And they love Messi from Argentina.
Right.
They love Ronaldo, who's from Portugal. They both play in the Spanish leagues. And when I'd make little trips to Nicaragua sometimes, there's nothing to do at 11 a.m. and got to kill some time before some things happen later in the afternoon, meeting up with a friend or doing some errands when shops are open. I try to watch the Spanish leagues. Real Madrid. Real Madrid and Barcelona. Mm-hmm. I love when those two match up because that's Messi versus Ronaldo. And I've seen some of the ESPN shows. This is a lot more than a one-sentence answer. I've seen some of the ESPN kinetic energy analysts about Ronaldo. And he's a unique specimen. I heard something recently about Messi. There's a team that passed on him. He's only about 5'4", 5'5". He's a little guy, but he's fast as hell, and he's very nimble at controlling the ball with his feet. And before you know it, you get a blast, and the ball's on the side corner of the net. He's a very skilled fellow. I won't be going, but I'll be watching it. I sometimes watch a game in a food court at a mall, and I'm the only gringo in the group. There might be 20 people watching, and all their tables are turned to the television set. It's a neat system where they got some food courts that have television. So they always steer it to a soccer game. Often it's the local Saprissa game in the Costa Rican League. There are about seven teams in the Costa Rican League. Saprissa is the favorite, and I've got myself a Saprissa shirt because if I look like one of them, maybe they won't rob me.
All right, then let's go on to Final Four number two.
Okay.
As an expat, this comes up on my site quite a bit. As people are wondering about, you know, do you stay in the U.S., that kind of stuff. If you could move anywhere, if, you know, not that you can't, but if it was just, you know, logistically possible for you to move anywhere right this moment, where would you go?
What do you mean, in the United States or in the
world? No, anywhere in the world. Yeah, where would you go?
I'd go to San Jose, Costa Rica. Why do you think I'm here? It's okay. A choice I've made. What kind of a dumbass question is that?
I don't know if maybe you were tired of there and you think there's some other place that's more ideal.
Okay, I'll tell you where my next stop might be if I ever become disenchanted for whatever reason that I don't want to get into.
Right.
Colombia.
Okay.
If I ever had to go to Asia, I would go to Singapore.
Okay.
If I ever had to go to Asia and I didn't want an island, I would go to Australia. So Colombia and Australia, and forget Uruguay. Uruguay has got a really good reputation that's not deserved.
Okay.
It's got some peaceful aspects, but I could fill your ear for 20 minutes on why it's nothing but a trap.
Well, then let's move on to Final Four question number three. Where will our friend Mr. Snowden be a year from now? He is in Russia at present, as you know. 1 year from now, where will he be?
I think either Russia or China. I think he's going to get tired of the winter.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
I've got a friend. I used to catch butterflies with him in my first memories of Mississippi. I was 3 years old when I lived in Mississippi, and we moved to Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, when I was seven. But we used to catch butterflies, me and Pat and his little brothers. My brother, me, Pat, his two brothers. We used to catch butterflies, make collections. Well, he moved after his college years and a couple of law firm stints. He didn't really like it in the United States. He didn't like professional life in the United States. And he learned Russian in college, which is, I think, quite an accomplishment. He was pretty good at it. So he said, I'm going to take this strange job and work in Moscow. And if it works out, I'm going to continue there. Well, I kept in touch with him all those years, and when Skype came in, he had a couple $40 conversations with me because I didn't have Skype. He said, Jim, just hook up Skype. Will you, for God's sake? Just hook it up. So I did, and he describes the winter there. He describes the 5 months, 6 months of winter. He describes the 20 below zero with winds. I don't think Snowden's going to cotton to that much. I think he's going to want to hang out in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I think he's going to want to hang out in a nice suburb with clean air, upwind, not downwind, upwind outside Shanghai. But, you know, I don't really know, and I don't really care, because there's a lot of naive views toward Snowden. People think, oh, gee, he's so exposed. Gosh, he's so alone. He's not alone at all. He's the visible piece of a 50-person army. 50-person army. And he's protected like you cannot imagine. I'm not talking about bodyguards. I'm talking about people who make phone calls and say, look, you interfere with him, and we will interfere with your 10 goons who are running around our country. And also, he's a technical expert. Just take a look at his resume, and you'll realize that he's not quite what he's made out to be. He's a very young fellow, about 31 years old. But here's the key. There are a few dozen back doors to the major, huge database that the managers, that the higher-ups cannot close because they don't know where they are. Think of it as a gigantic castle 10 times the size of Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, Germany. 10 times the size, with dozens of little trap doors and little exits that, oh gosh, you take that little tunnel and you end up in the forest 50 yards over that away. That's what this database is all about. And I've been promised that for the next 6 to 18 months, we're going to have a string of the most god-awful revelations about the files and what the U.S. has been up to with their financial hegemony, genocide, and whatever. It's going to be ugly, and I keep asking the same question. When are they going to reveal through these files and databases how the New York banks are fully dependent on narco money coming from Afghanistan? Yeah. One of these databases is going to reveal that the NATO bases are the trafficking points headed to London and Germany.
And God, Jim, God only knows what else. Maybe that'll be our final straw.
Assassinations.
Yeah.
How about the real story, what went on in Libya?
I mean, anything.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, final question.
Okay.
Blondes, brunettes, or redheads?
What do I like?
Yeah, which do you prefer?
I get that question sometimes from the gals in San Jose, Costa Rica.
I bet you do.
And here's what I tell them. No me importa los colores del cabello. Me importa que son bellas.
I can only imagine what that means.
No me importa el color. No me importa. Me gusta delgadas con caderas lindas.
Hey, I got an idea. I don't want you to translate that. Just leave that hanging out there, and we'll let some.
No. I'm going to translate that. I say it's not important to me the color of their hair. It's important that they're beautiful. I don't care about the color of their hair. I care that they're slender and have nice.
Jim, always nice, a gentleman, my friend.
Built for speed.
Going straight for the heartstrings on that one. All right, my friend, let's call it a day. Thank you very, very much. As I speak for the collective heart of Turdville, from the collective heart of Turdville, thank you for all this time. And I know it's been eye-opening in many regards for everybody that has listened. And I look forward. I thank you for your generosity. I know you'll volunteer to do this again sometime in the future. And again, where do people find your work? Where do they sign up for your newsletter? Tell us all about thegoldenjackass.com.
Y tal vez me gustan las bolas de tetas.
I can't even continue. Tell everybody about the hat trick letter.
The website is called goldenjackass.com. There's public stuff there. There's always public stuff there about articles. I used to write one a week. I don't know how I did it for five straight years. I did one a week. That's 250 public articles. But it's quite a long list there. I guess someday it'll be a resume item. But I do about one a month now, public article writing. And it also lists what I prefer to do more and more. It's the radio interviews. They're more fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I like writing. I love writing. But I get tired of writing for the paid reports. But the interviews are fun. And besides, it could really delve into a topic and explain a little bit more in other dimensions. Like, where can you really capture the emotion in a written article?
Right. Right.
People tell me, oh, gosh, I listened to your radio interview with Turd or somebody else, and you know, it's amazing that you make it sound kind of intriguing, and you got a lot of emotion in there. This is interesting stuff, and it's not really evident in your public articles. So there's that. Anyway, I got two reports. One is called the Money War Report, and that is higher-level stuff, dollar alternative development, Eastern Alliance, and their movement toward the BRICS development and gold trade settlement and Turkish intermediate, a lot of that stuff. And then there's the lower level, not that it's lesser important, it's ground level war stuff, and that is what I call the gold and currency report. And that has to do with monetary policy and what's going on with competitive devaluations and competing currency wars and movement of gold in India and demand in Hong Kong and just a lot of things, the coins, the mints. There's a remarkable thing that's going on with the U.S. and Canada. The silver coin demand from U.S. and Canada, just the coins, is 25 million more ounces in silver than the two countries produce.
Right, right, right.
And then on top of that, you have the industrial demand. That's all in deficit. On top of the 25 million, so I've got those two reports, and I've come to notice that the radio interviews result in a faster response and a bigger response for new orders to come in, and an interesting phenomenon, Turd. It's not just new orders; it's new people. It's not like I keep track. I do a search immediately on an email address or a last name. Are they coming back from 3 years ago? And I, you know, about 20% of my subscribers are new orders, rather, are people who are coming back from the past. I call them returns. And sometimes it's from a billing problem. They come back in 3 months or they come back in 3 days. But I'm noticing a lot more new blood, new. They're, I mean, just in the last 3 days, I think I have one who was a swap for a billing problem, and the rest are all new. Okay, the radio interviews bring new blood, and I want new blood because the U.S. is a big population, and they need – well, it's not just U.S. It's the English-speaking world, and there are a lot of English-speaking Germans and Swiss out there.
Sure.
And then you always have the Brits, the Scots. I got people from Scotland and Ireland. I got more from Ireland than I do Scotland, which is a little surprising. But anyway,
well, it's a great site and it's a great service, and I encourage everybody to check it out and strongly consider joining because you get the public article every once in a while, and you get these podcasts with me, and I know you've been with Greg Hunter and the Doc and you know, all kinds of places, but that Money War Report, the really inside baseball stuff is just invaluable. So I want to strongly advise everybody to give it their full consideration. Jim, thank you for all your time. You are a true resource and a valuable member of Turdville, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
Oh, I fully hope to, and look forward to the next invitation. And my last comment is, recomiendo un viaje a Centro Américo para disfrutar las chicas.
I don't even speak Spanish, and I think I know what you just said.
Recomiendo un viaje a Centro América y disfrutar. Disfrutar is enjoy. All right,
my friend. You disrotar the rest of the day, and hopefully we'll speak again sometime soon.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
You got it, Jim.